Good afternoon. We're delighted to welcome you all. We have here students from Kewaskum High School. Would they please stand?
Wow.
Good to see you all. You may be seated. The students are here with a program entitled Court with Class. This program is sponsored by the State Bar and by this court. We invite high school students from across the state to enjoy come to an oral argument. And if the invitation is accepted, we send the students material about the case. They might engage in some activities relating to the case. They come to oral argument. And were you at the noon session with Justice Gableman? Yes or no? Yes. Good. The students, most of the time the students come in the morning, and after the second case, they join all the students that have come that day and speak with a justice who has been assigned that day. And the discussion was had. It was about the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of any of the cases we have heard. If anyone would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, the deputy marshal has such a summary. So if you'd raise your hand, it's better to listen if you know the facts and know some of the issues. Okay, we've missed that opportunity. Now I'll introduce the members of the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice, who are you today? Patrick
we have
Ruff.
To Peter the line.
I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right, Justice David Prosser, and on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call the last case for today, 08AP170, Walter Tatera versus FMC Corporation. I've got the lineup of speakers as follows. Representing FMC, 20 minutes, Mr. Rocher. 5 minutes, Brian Cahill, representing the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance, that's Amicus Curiae. 30 minutes, Ms. Rakowski. And then 5 minutes, Mr. DeRusha for rebuttal. All right, counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, good afternoon. Mark DeRoche appearing on behalf of FMC Corporation. I'd also introduce attorney George Fitzpatrick from the law firm of Swanson, Martin & Bell, also appearing on behalf of FMC Corporation this afternoon. The legal issues in this case turn on the relationship of the parties, and it was clearly one of principal and independent contractor. By definition, an independent contractor is one who contracts with another to do something but is not controlled by the other, nor subject to the other's right to control with respect to physical conduct and the performance of the undertaking. That fits our facts. And the facts, very briefly, are this. FMC, through a company that it owned named Stearns Electric, which is a Milwaukee-based manufacturer of industrial electric brakes, was and still is, hired, contracted with B&M Machine, an experienced Milwaukee-based machine shop, to machine overflow parts for Stearns brakes. What I mean by overflow is generally the parts were machined by Stearns employees in-house, and they were only sent out to a machine shop like B&M when there was overflow and there was the need. FMC paid B&M for this service, but it did not control the manner in which B&M did the work in any respect. This is a classic principal and independent contractor relationship and controlled by this court's decision in Wagner, which confirmed the general rule that a principal is not liable in negligence for injury to the independent contractor's employee.
Let's take a look at Wagner. The holding, as set forth in the third paragraph of Wagner, was, we conclude that an employee of an independent contractor is precluded from receiving workers' compensation benefits from the independent contractor and also maintaining a tort action against the person who employs the independent contractor, the principal employer or general contractor, unless the principal employer is affirmatively negligent with respect to the employee. So that's the holding. My threshold question is, what does the record reflect regarding the receipt of workers' compensation benefits from the independent contractor?
It does not reflect whether or not Mr. Terra received workers' compensation benefits, Justice, but I would maintain that that doesn't make a difference.
The way that I read Wagner, and Justice Steinmetz wrote it, and I'm looking now at page 386, because Justice Steinmetz knew, but apparently the parties didn't know, because he says they didn't brief it, that under workers' comp, and I'm reading from page 386. Do you have that in front of you? I want to give you a chance to...
I think I have the northwest page numbering, Justice, but I can...
You're going to have to...
838.
Thank you.
Because under workers' comp, and Justice Steinmetz was talking about that on my page 386, under 10206, there's what you call the contractor under theory, right? And as Justice Steinmetz explains, look, there's a unique thing in workers' comp. Workers' comp is the exclusive remedy for the employer. But what happens if the employer is an independent contractor and doesn't have any insurance, doesn't have money? And so we've evolved this contractor under theory that makes the general contractor liable for workers' comp when the contractor doesn't have it. Justice Steinmetz says, apparently, the parties have assume that an independent contractor's employee is not precluded from bringing an action in tort against a general contractor who has not provided workers' compensation benefits. But he goes on to say or says right at that same time, but it should be noted the parties in this case haven't even briefed this issue. So, and the issue is whether or not the general contractor has the immunity from tort liability that the employer has under workers' comp. So I see that's really what is at play in this opinion, and it feeds right into the holding. That is, we conclude that an employee of an independent contractor is precluded from receiving workers' comp benefits and going after, etc. So how do we know if the holding applies if we don't know if there's workers' comp benefits, right?
I guess I just disagree with your interpretation, Justice. And my reading, and I'm certainly familiar with what you just read, my reading of that is the court went through an analysis to decide if what you were talking about in that decision is whether the principal contractor had statutory immunity or not. Mm-hmm. And my reading of that decision was that it decided that it wasn't basing its decision upon the statutory immunity, and that it made its decision based upon a theory of common law immunity.
Do you do with the language of the holding that sets as arguably a condition precedent that when the employee is receiving workers' compensation benefits from the independent contract?
I think you think that that doesn't make a lot of sense, Justice. I think that's what you do. Because,
don't tell Justice Steinmetz.
Okay. I don't think that was the conclusion of the case, and I don't interpret it that way, because It doesn't make sense to me to have a rule that would expose the principal to tort liability based on circumstances outside of its control. In other words, it can't force the employee to make a claim for workers' compensation benefits from the employer, much less control whether or not those benefits are received. It would permit the employee the choice of pursuing a tort action against the principal rather than seeking the employer provided and statutorily required benefits. So I think that the public policy factors upon which Wagner is based are sound, and I think they're supported by my interpretation of Justice Steinmetz's decision.
Well, the conclusion said, unless the principal employer is affirmatively negligent with respect to the employee, is that required?
Unless the principal employer is affirmatively negligent.
We conclude that an employee of an independent contractor is precluded from receiving workers' comp benefits from an independent contractor and also maintaining a tort action. That's what we're talking about here, right? Against the person who employs the independent contractor. That's what we're talking about here.
What we're talking about.
The principal employer or general contractor, unless the principal employer is affirmatively negligent with respect to the employee.
That's certainly one of the exceptions in the case, mm-hmm. Justice, yes.
And that's what the issue is here? Or one of the issues?
It's one of the issues.
All right. What do you think the issue is here?
Well, I could cut right to the chase.
Good.
Because I think at the end of the day, plaintiffs arguing that Restatement Section 388 now is the basis for her claim. And if you take a look at Section 388, and I am truly at the end of the day, assuming we get to this point, because I certainly have a lot of arguments along the way. But if we get to that point, and you're sitting there deciding and looking at these facts and saying, do these facts support a finding that FMC had no reason to believe that B&M would realize its dangerous condition? And I think there's no way you could look at these facts, and you have sufficient facts, and make that conclusion. So
the Tatera estate has never alleged that B and M was negligent, right?
The Tatera estate has never made a claim against B&M, and
so,
best of my knowledge, did not assert a workers' compensation claim.
So do you think then it follows that under the second Wagner exception, their claim must fail? I mean, how can you be liable?
We can't, and that's the whole basis of the Wagner decision. Is the public policy behind the Wagner decision applies in spades to this to our case, and I did jump ahead, but I can certainly come back to what you're talking about, Justice.
So I would like to spend a few minutes following up on Justice Siegler's question. The holding. The recitation in Wagner states the general rule, and this is at 388 of the Wisconsin Second. And the general rule states, Wisconsin follows the general rule that a principal employer, here one in the position of FMC, is not liable to others for the torts of independent contractors. There are two exceptions. First, a principal employer may be liable to the independent contractor's employee for injuries caused by the principal employer's affirmative act of negligence. Does not appear to be the claim here. There does not appear to be a claim of an affirmative act of negligence by FMC to Mr. Tatera. True?
That's true. The claim is based upon a failure to warn, which on its face is an act of omission rather than an act of commission. So I would agree.
The second exception, and I'm quoting from the language, second, a principal employer may be held vicariously liable for the negligence of an independent contractor when the contractor's employee is injured while performing inherently dangerous activities. Now, there was a lot of language, a lot of ink spent on the inherently dangerous versus extra hazardous, ultra hazardous. but not much about the vicarious liability. I'm particularly interested in your view, and I'll ask your opposing counsel, about the issue of vicarious liability and its interplay with that second exception, which seems to form the basis for the claim.
That's an interesting point, and I hadn't gotten to that in my analysis. I analyzed it from the standpoint of the activity and you know, we can narrow down exactly what the activity is, but if we look at it broadly and say the activity is working with asbestos and whether that's an extra hazardous activity
or not. And that certainly seemed to be what both parties were focusing on, was the nature of the activity itself leads to a per se finding of liability on the part of FMC. And that, I think, is why so much effort, it appears to be, correct me if I'm wrong, was spent in indicating the respective arguments of the parties concerning the extra hazardous nature of the work versus the inherent danger of the work.
I don't know if it would lead to a per se finding of negligence. I think what it does is open the door to a potential claim being made against somebody in the position of the principal.
What I meant by per se was without further showing. When the phrase, my attention was drawn to the language in Wagner concerning vicarious liability, which seems to infer a requirement of some kind of liability to form the basis of the vicarious nature of it, here B&M.
Well, then for that additional reason, this plaintiff's claim must fail.
But you haven't looked at that before today.
I had not looked at that before today. I focused on the extra hazardous language.
But isn't your whole assumption here that B&M was negligent? I mean, that's part of your B under 388, that they knew about the hazard?
No. That's not part of my assumption
okay.
at all, and I think that's putting the cart before the horse, and that's why
okay.
we need to keep in mind what the relationship here is of the parties and the public policy reasons behind Wagner, and this court's familiar with them. You know, FMC, the Court of Appeals has said this isn't our product, okay? So this court should not be looking at this case from a standpoint automatically assuming that FMC had superior knowledge. It was not our product. And the problem with 388 is it's not universally, but almost always, in my experience and in reading the cases, applied in situations where you're talking about somebody's product. And I have a hard time conceptually with the fact that we're now plaintiffs asserting a claim based on 388 in a case where we're not talking about somebody's product. And I think the court should think long and hard about if and how it wants to expand the use of Section 388. But assuming it does and finds that it applies to a case like this because you read the comments or there's a case or two out there where 388 has been applied in a situation where we're not talking about the product, then I think you need to look at it from the standpoint of what the circumstances are and look at it on its face. If we're going to apply this and plaintiff is going to use 388 as a sword in this case, Justice, then these are the elements I think that plaintiff needs to prove. If I'm using, your question was, am I saying that B&M was negligent? No, and I don't think I need to say that in order for element B of Section 388 to fail. I think the way this case is postured, and it's unusual because 388 has of late come up in, as you're aware, in appellate cases where the sophisticated user doctrine is asserted as a defense. And if we get to that point, and I have all along asserted it as a defense, to use it as a shield, but I think the way the case is postured, plaintiff is using it affirmatively, and it's up to plaintiff to show that FMC had no reason to believe that B&M would realize its dangerous condition. And on these facts, I don't know how you could make that finding.
The amicus brief says that the plaintiff and defendant here are like ships, two ships passing in the night. Sounds good. And I'm somewhat sympathetic with that because it, already in the argument, we've heard two theories. One, Justice Gableman talking about the Wagner case and the liability of the principal employer to employees of the of an independent contractor. And it has rules, right? Affirmative act of negligence, vicarious liability, extra hazardous. That's one box. Then we have the second box, which is 388, which you're talking about. And in, let's see, in, I think in Wagner, you couldn't have said he was a supplier. I don't think that Wagner would have fit under 388. But in your case, you've got a personal property that is a chattel. So it looks like initially it could fit under 388. And 388 has its box with its requirements, right? And there's some overlap, but not total overlap. I mean, that's how I see it. Do you agree?
I agree, and I've spent a long time thinking about it, Justice. Well, and I haven't figured out whether you should approach it from the 388 angle first or from the Wagner angle
first.
Well,
that's what I was want to talk to you about. The as I remember looking at the Court of Appeals decision, what they did is approach it both ways and said you fit under both. Lucky, right? You didn't have to make choices. So my question to you is, do you fit under both? Do you fit under neither? Which do you think should be applied?
Okay. I'm certainly interested in how the court goes about arriving at its decision. I've already said at the end of the day what the court's decision should be regardless, based upon the facts that the court has before it. But I think what you're asking me is, and I sort of got the impression the plaintiff was arguing this, is should we be carving out some kind of third exception from Wagner in a situation because in a situation where the principal gives the item to be worked on, and I would say no to that question. I think
which
that would
one
be,
do you want to govern your case, Wagner, 388, or neither?
I think Wagner's dispositive of the case. Justice, it's not an affirmative act, and it's not an extra hazardous activity, and that could be the end of the story right there.
Well, you know, the Court of Appeals said that passed this as an affirmative act, right?
It did, yes.
And when you read Prosser and Keaton and others, they say almost every omission can be recast and rephrased as a commission.
And that's the problem. It would eviscerate the rule because you could do it with the circumstances in Wagner, negligent hiring. The hiring could be cast as an affirmative act, but this court has said that that's not an affirmative act. And I would put a failure to warn on that same level.
Counsel, one of my traditional questions is how would you write the opinion?
The red light came on, and I'm just notified you of that, Justice.
I see it. It won't save you at the moment.
I think you can write the opinion and say that on the facts this court had before it, that a failure to warn is not an affirmative act of negligence, that based upon the record before us, working with asbestos is not an extra hazardous activity, let alone going down the funnel and talking about what Mr. Tatera was doing. And then grudgingly, I think I would say that you could say that while there may be situations where Section 388 would apply under circumstances like this, it doesn't fit the facts of this case.
Why not?
I'm going to go back to my my conception of, and I think I'm not alone out there among practitioners. When we think about Section 388 of the Restatement of Torts, well, the first thing that came to mind was the sophisticated user cases, because that's sort of when it came to the forefront. And, you know, this court hasn't used Section 388 of the Restatement a lot. I came up with two cases. So I have to assume that means, I could assume that means that you're using it cautiously. But the main reason conceptually I have a hard time applying 388 to the facts of this case is what I stated earlier, and that's it's almost exclusively used in cases where you're talking about somebody's product. And I don't have a problem. The trial court in this case said, well, it doesn't apply because it only applies to manufacturers. Well, that's not true. And I guess part of where my conception is coming from is from the jury instruction. And the jury instruction that adopts Section 388 of the Restatement is found under Chapter 32, which is the products liability chapter of the jury instruction. So anyone wanting to sort of figure out what failure to warn claims are all about and sees Section 388 of the Restatement referenced in the footnote is going to think that it applies to cases where we're talking about somebody's product. Sure, it's manufacturers and suppliers, but we're talking about a product. And in this case, the Court of Appeals has told us, and we're not talking about a product.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Madam Chief Justices, good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Brian Cahill. I'm an attorney with Godfrey & Kahn, and we represent the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance. First, I'd like to thank the court for giving us the opportunity to appear here today. I'm here today to ask the court to clarify two principles of law. The first is, what is the standard of liability for a principal employer to the employee of a subcontractor? Chief Justice, you asked, how does Wagner and Section 388 fit together? I think the answer is they're layered on top of one another. Okay. Before you get to the Section 388 analysis, you have to first meet one of the exceptions in Wagner. And the starting point is in Wagner is the premise that an employee of a subcontractor must seek compensation in workers' compensation, not in tort law, against a principal employer. Only if one of the exceptions in Wagner applies do you even begin to conduct a Section 388 analysis of the restatements. The second principle that I ask this court to clarify is to confirm that the sophisticated user doctrine is a valid defense to a failure to warn claim. Turning first to
the same as sub B? I mean, is that just the opposite of sub B?
I believe that the sophisticated user defense doctrine is based in sub B of Section 388.
So are you taking the layered approach, the layering approach to 388 in regard to the exceptions in Wagner with the idea that the way that a claimant would establish an affirmative act of negligence would be, for instance, by showing a failure in Section 388. Is that where you're going with that? You're saying, look at Wagner, look at the two exceptions, affirmative act of negligence from the principal employer to the employee of the contractor, or extra hazardous activity plus vicarious liability.
I think some of the acts that may qualify under sub B 388 will also potentially satisfy the affirmative acts.
If it's an affirmative act.
Yes.
And I assume you may or may not be taking a position on whether the failure to warn is an affirmative act.
I believe by definition the failure to warn is an omission.
Right. And therefore not affirmative.
Correct.
Did you look at the vicarious liability part of the second exception in Wake?
I did not look at it specifically. I viewed it as surplusage, given that the Wagner case kind of had its origins in vicarious liability and whether you could assign vicarious liability to the principal employer.
Well, if the second exception states, and I'll just quote it, second, a principal employer may be held vicariously liable for the negligence of an independent contractor, here B&M, when the contractor's employee is injured while performing inherently dangerous activities, does that infer that there are two parts to that exception?
I believe you are correct. It does suggest that to satisfy that exception, you would first have to establish the negligence of B&M. The test then under Wagner is as established by FMC's counsel. Wagner prevents an injured employee from proceeding in tort law against the principal unless one of two exceptions apply. The first exception requires that the principal's affirmative acts of negligence increase the risk of injury. Non-negligent affirmative acts are not enough, and neither are omissions. The second exception requires that the work performed by the subcontractor be extra hazardous. In this case, neither exception applies.
Counsel, one of the affidavits, as I recall in reading this, indicates that there is no safe level of exposure to asbestos. I'm not sure that's true or not, but it seems to me that that averment arguably could give rise to a factual determination. Ergo, summary judgment would not be appropriate. Any comments?
Yes. That affidavit is really applicable to the second Wagner exception as to extra hazardous work.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the definition of extra hazardous work in Wagner is, can the activity be performed by taking proper precautions such that the risk of injury can be minimized? Wagner makes the point, and subsequent appellate cases have made the point, that you don't need to eliminate the risk. It needs to be minimized. Mm-hmm. So the fact that there's an affidavit stating that there's no safe level, I think that's ultimately not a material fact that would preclude summary judgment, given that the standard is only that it minimized the risk.
Thank you. The red lights on.
Justice
Prosser.
This is all common law, is it not?
Correct.
And you're talking about affirmative act of negligence. Shouldn't there be a passive act of negligence? What public policy militates against a passive act of negligence?
I guess first I would look to the Wagner decision. You would first have to overrule the Wagner decision in cases that follow that. As to why not a passive negligent act, Wagner is concerned about, has the principal employer done something to increase the risk of injury to the subcontractor's employee? An act of omission typically isn't going to do that. And in that circumstance, public policy is best served where the principal hasn't done anything to increase the risk by directing that employee to seek compensation in the workers' compensation system, not tort law.
Is omission the same as passive? It's a trick question. Time's up.
I think passive is probably broader and definitely encompasses omission. I'm sure there's scenarios where they're not identical.
All right. I have this question. You say they have to be layered. Why do you put Wagner on top or first? Or does it make any difference what you put first?
I think Wagner does go on top because I think Wagner tells us whether you can proceed with a negligence claim in the first place. And then 388 tells you what the content of that negligence claim would be.
Got it. Thank you.
May I finish with one concluding thought?
Yes, you may have a short sentence.
In conclusion, I guess we'd ask that the court find that the layered approach of Wagner and 388 is appropriate and that the sophisticated user doctrine is inherent and part of Section 388.
What does that mean in this particular case? Does it go back for trial? Retrial? Was this a summary judgment? Yeah.
Summary judgment.
Does it go back for trial?
I don't believe that's necessary. The trial court didn't believe it was. As to the any factual problems, I would defer to Mr. Desrochers on that.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Jakowski.
May it please the court, good afternoon, justices and chief.
Good afternoon.
And counsel, and my client, Vicki Tatera. To address the issue that we ended with, I believe 388 needs to be on top of the layer, and the reason is why. We're dealing with a product here. We're really not talking about the typical contractor-subcontractor situation, which Wagner and all the other cases, they resulted in a construction setting. Here, FMC is bringing this dangerous product into a set location for B&M to work on. That's what called a bailment. That's why 388, which is the negligent bailment statute, was created to address these situations, because we don't want people bringing hazardous products into a location and without warning of the hazards. And because this is a bailment, that's why 388 comes on top, because we're dealing with a different situation here than the cases in Wagner.
Counselor, every time you have a chain of manufacture where you have different people doing parts of a final product and one or two people sending out items to be adjusted, is it always a bailment? Is that what a manufacturer is if you have different? What about the Toyota with their brake? Is that a bailment?
If it meets the 388, I suggest that it is, Justice. It's the classic case of FMC brought the product in and said...
I'm just looking generally at manufacturing generally. I understood your argument and I read your brief and it was well put together, so I understand what you're saying. I'm just trying to look at it in a larger context than this particular case, which is kind of how we generally do. And I'm wondering, you know, what we have here is several people involved in manufacturing these brakes. And one of them is FMC, another one is the employer of Mr. Tatera, or the former employer. And I'm just wondering if you are manufacturing a product, an end product, which is the brakes, and different people are playing different parts, as those parts move around, is it just a succession of bailments? Is that kind of how your argument would go?
Justice Rogensack, I would say that this is somewhat unusual in that, like the Toyota example, Toyota certainly gets parts from all different suppliers.
Right.
But it may not be as usual that Toyota brings parts to a supplier at request that they do something with the part and then receives it back. And in this case, it actually wasn't the usual practice. FMC normally machined these parts. Only when they became overloaded did they take the parts to B&M.
Counsel, I've got a question to follow up with Justice Rogensack. My understanding is that your bailment argument has entered the picture rather late in this case. And opposing counsel says we ought not to really consider the bailment argument. What's your response to that, if any?
My response to that, Justice, is, and I prepared for this, if you look at the trial court brief, 388 has been an issue in this case from the trial court forward. The comment C to 388 says, by the way, this is the negligent bailment statute. So if you look at record 188, our response to summary judgment motion, 388 is discussed as our theory of liability. Record 265 in the second summary judgment motion, there were two in this case. The first one, Justice Fiorenza dismissed, basically by the reasons that Justice Bradley raised. The second one was granted. 388 was discussed, and the trial court made findings.
But 388 was discussed within the context of the negligent failure to warn context.
Right. And I believe that there's an element of negligent failure to warn in 388, because that's the third prong. They failed to warn about the hazardous nature of the product.
At C.
C, correct. So I don't believe it's waived. If you want to say semantics, we didn't refer to it as a bailment. We referred to it as a 388 case. The fact remains, it's a bailment. That's the bailment restatement section.
Hey, I've got another question, if I might. My understanding of the Court of Appeals decision was that, among other things, they found that there were genuine issues of material fact, and therefore that summary judgment in regard to the negligence claim was inappropriate. Can you point to any genuine issues of material fact that would support that determination by the Court of Appeals?
Certainly. The issue, there's three prongs, as we talked about for 388, whether FMC supplied a hazardous product. There was evidence put forth by that. Evidence put forth by FMC, by their expert, that this product was not hazardous. As to the second prong, whether or not B&M knew of the hazards of asbestos, there was certainly evidence put forth by FMC that, or put forth by plaintiff, that FMC knew of the hazards and failed to warn, which actually goes to the first prong. To the second prong, there was no evidence put forth by FMC that B&M knew of the hazardous nature of asbestos. And the Wisconsin Assurance Alliance, and by the way, this is the sophisticated user section of that 388, which was not, that was actually waived by FMC at the Supreme Court level because they didn't raise it in their brief. And I didn't address it in my responsive brief, and I specifically said on page 12, this is why I didn't address it, because I believe it's been waived. They're not talking about it in their brief anymore. Let's focus on the other issues. Now, in reply, it's been resurrected, and I'll address it. The only evidence put forth by counsel, and mainly by the Insurance Alliance, that B&M knew or should have known of the hazards is basically a statement that, well, everybody knows dust is hazardous. Everybody knows not to breathe dust. So that's enough for us to show that B&M knew or should have known of the hazards of asbestos. I don't think that that gets you there, certainly not at summary judgment. The other evidence they put forth was there was a 1947 Wisconsin Industrial Commission statute that had listings of hundreds of products that could be hazardous, and asbestos was listed among them, along with wood and wool. That's not enough. This court has spoken on sophisticated user, and to hold that that's enough is essentially to hold that any company that's ever used an asbestos product in the manufacture, or just even a tile contractor or a roofer that may have contained asbestos is now a sophisticated user of asbestos. That's not enough to make this company a sophisticated user. They need to show more. This company, as stated, Bud Tatera was the only employee. His father owned it. FMC points to a couple other employees, a brother-in-law, a sister-in-law. It's a small company, and there's been no showing that they had any level of sophistication in regard to asbestos. FMC's products were the only asbestos products that they worked on. And they only did so occasionally. Generally, FMC did.
Counsel, you've referenced comment C to section 388 of the restatement second in the context of bailments. And it is accurate to say that within the comment, these rules, quote, apply to all kinds of bailors, irrespective of whether the bailment is for a reward or gratuitous, and irrespective of whether the bailment is for use, transportation, safekeeping, or repair. And do you have that comment in front of you?
Yes, I do.
All right. Which one was this?
Well, I would say that they're giving examples of the type of bailment, but if you had to select one, it's most linked to a repair. They have a brake lining. It's not exactly the manner they want it. They need part of it shaved off. So they brought to this company to make it appropriately shaped for their final product, which they sent out to customers. And to actually say, for FMC to say, we're not in the business of selling asbestos brakes or manufacturing, well, that was their business. They sold these brakes to people all over for industrial use. All
right. To be clear, FMC would ship over to B&M for work by others, including the late Mr. Tatera, for grinding down of discs to fit the specifications that FMC set forward. Now, how that was going to be accomplished was usually apparently up to the employee from the record. What method? Sometimes there would be a diagram or a drawing in order to accomplish that. But then once the employee finished that part of the manufacture of the product, it was shipped back to FMC. I think that's what the record indicates.
That's correct.
Could you please describe a friction disc for me?
We're talking about is something different than a brake disc. These are for electrical brakes, a crane overhead in a factory. So, but they are similar. And so it's basically a curved lining. It's sort of a hard material. And apparently they weren't shaped to the appropriate manner that FMC needed them. So FMC put them on a lathe to shape them. And when they became overloaded, they sent them to B&M for shaping.
What other materials were part of the composition of these friction discs?
In the final disc that was sent to the FMC customers, it included a lot of metallic parts, a brake component. But when the linings were sent over, it was just simply the linings. And that's what the record reflects.
But when B&M got it, what was in that disc?
The disc itself? Well, I think the Wisconsin Assurance Alliance has submitted information to show that these contain 40 to 50% asbestos. So asbestos was the binder for these discs, and when it was ground, as the evidence we put forth, fibers were released in the air.
But now, if I had one of these discs in front of me before the grinding, would there be any asbestos particles coming out?
We have submitted evidence, and it is in my brief, that simply the box that contains these discs, before any grinding takes place, the box contained billions of asbestos fibers. And that, secondly, simple handling of the discs would release asbestos fibers. Now, certainly the most asbestos fibers that would be released would be when you're putting it on this lathe. But the asbestos fibers are present from the time they're dropped off and just by mere handling. And that's why we think that FMC may contend, we have no idea what they were doing with these linings, but we've put forth evidence which has established a genuine issue of material fact that those linings were hazardous before B&M even touched them.
When the boxes arrived and were opened, were the fibers visible?
Asbestos fibers would have been invisible.
Invisible?
Yes.
But it wouldn't have been invisible once the grinding started, would it?
Certainly, and I don't know that this is part of the record, and I don't want to get too far afield, but certainly dust would be visible, but as far as an individual fiber being visible, I think the evidence will show that it is not. I think actually in the record, it's many times smaller than a human hair.
Counsel, it doesn't appear as if the plaintiff ever asserted a negligence claim as to B&M. Is that true?
That's true, Your Honor. I believe that, well, B&M was no longer in existence. It was closed in the 80s. And if we did, certainly Wisconsin workers' compensation
wasn't it 96? I think 90s. B&M went out of business when?
It might have been 96 that the actual corporation records were.
But it seems more than that. At the circuit court, the record indicates that you were asked twice, I believe, by the circuit court judge, whether you were alleging any kind of negligence on the part of B&M, any kind of negligent activity. Was there any negligence on the part of B&M?
Justice, certainly it wasn't my contention at that time because I'm trying to prove a case, and pursuant to Connor versus West Shore, B&M, when we get time to have a verdict form, will be on the verdict form, and the jury will be allowed to apportion negligence. And certainly I'm FMC would argue, according to Wisconsin Safe Place Act, they had a duty to Mr. Tatera. And I'm certain that the judge would present the company on the verdict form.
The reason why I ask runs to, and I indicated that I would give you an opportunity to comment on the second exception in Wagner as well, in regard to vicarious liability. And I would like you to comment on that part of the second exception at this time.
Sure. And I don't even think we need to get to Wagner, but in getting to your question, if FMC is going to be held vicariously liable for the negligence of B&M, then obviously it's an assume that B&M had some negligence. Mr. Tatera was injured. He had mesothelioma. He died from it, from asbestos. If FMC is not negligent, then who is in this case but B&M? But in this case, I don't think that the evidence will show, and what we'll present to the jury, is that B&M had a dust collection in place, and that's in the record.
For part of the time.
For part of the time. And that FMC never warned, and B&M actually had no recognition of these asbestos fibers.
My understanding is it's either or in Wagner. That is, you can win if you have an affirmative negligent act, or you can show vicarious liability in extra hazardous material. Is that right?
That's my understanding.
So you might not ever have to get to the second aspect of extra hazardous and vicarious.
That's correct. And the Court of Appeals found that there was evidence of an affirmative act. And one thing that's different, if you look at the jury instruction, affirmative act must be an act of commission, something someone does. And that's why the fact that this is a bailment rather than a construction setting actually plays a role in this too, because FMC is bringing this product, sorry for the microphone, bringing this product into the purview of B&M. And so that is an affirmative act. They're bringing a hazardous product into the purview, and that's what the Court of Appeals found is the affirmative act. And when they brought it in, right at that time, it was emitting asbestos fibers.
I'm sorry, did I just understand you in response to the Chief Justice's question to indicate that an extra hazardous activity in and of itself would serve as the basis of the second exception?
I think what my response was that there were two exceptions to Wagner, one being the affirmative act and one being the extra hazardous activity. And if I can meet either or both,
then
I can get past Wagner.
Doesn't this, and my questioning went to the second exception in regard to the extra hazardous duty, and that's what I'm trying to get squared away here with my questions of your opposing counsel and you. The second exception says a principal employer may be held vicariously liable for the negligence of an independent contractor when the contractor's employee is injured while performing inherently dangerous activities. Now, I think one reading of that certainly would require an inherently dangerous activity or an extra hazardous activity and vicarious liability through the general contract.
And another thing I would add to our earlier discussion is, if this is an inherently dangerous activity, shouldn't there be some awareness of that inherent dangerousness, and isn't it negligence on behalf of FMC or that if they know that this is an inherently dangerous activity?
I'll tell you what, I'll answer your question as soon as you answer mine. Do you agree that that's a reasonable reading of the second exception?
Yes. To get back to 388, I believe that 388, there's actually been no cases on 388 that involve this kind of situation, but this bailment, if we can show that they knew or should have known, which I believe we have, and the Court of Appeals found, there's at least a material issue of fact, and when they brought this product into B&M, and that it injured the plaintiff, which is not really being disputed here, and they failed to warn, which is also not in dispute, then this case has to go to a jury. And whether or not Wagner applies, when we're talking about a bailment, I think we're talking about a different issue than in contractor, independent contractor. And if you look at every single case cited by FMC, the defendant had nothing to do with the injury-causing product. Even Wagner, the plaintiff fell off a roof that was dilapidated. That wasn't the defendant's roof. That defendant had nothing to do with that. If you look at all of the other cases involving Wagner, there's a good reason why the defendant may not be held, whether it be vicariously liable or liable. But in this case, FMC is bringing the product into the purview of the plaintiff. And so I believe that's why 388 would apply first.
What difference does it make? You have to satisfy both?
I don't believe you do. 388 is a theory of liability, negligent bailment. Independent contractor, sure. Did FMC hire B&M? But I provide an example in my brief, and I think it's very similar. Imagine you go to a dry cleaner, and you have arsenic contamination on your clothes, and you know it, and you know it's hazardous. Under FMC's view of the law in Wisconsin, you don't have to tell that dry cleaner, that front desk worker, about this contamination. They're an experienced dry cleaner. You just leave it there, and then if that employee is injured, they have to look to the dry cleaning company. And they can't look to FMC, and I just don't believe that would be the law in Wisconsin.
So if I can understand your different position, your position is you first have to satisfy, you first go to 388. If you, as the supplier, you call it bailor, supplier, fits within 388, then, that is the FMC is the supplier, then there's liability, and you don't have to look at Wagner. Is that right?
That's right, because of the bailment nature of the situation.
And if you start out with, if I understood opposing counsel, they'd start out with Wagner, and they'd have to satisfy both.
Yes, they'd start out with Wagner, and if that is the state of the law, then the dry cleaning employee would have no cause of action against the person that brought the arsenic contaminated clothes, knowing they were hazardous, if that's the state of the law. I just want to comment on some of the cases regarding whether or not working with asbestos is an extra hazardous activity. The Court of Appeals found it was, and FMC...
Is it a question of fact or law?
It's a question of law.
Okay.
And the cases cited by FMC for the proposition that working with asbestos is not an extra hazardous activity actually, for the most part, don't involve working with asbestos like Mr. Jatera was doing. They cite a leasing case, and the issue was, is owning a building that has asbestos an extra hazard activity? And the court said, of course not. Anyone that has a house that was built before 1960 would be involved in an extra hazardous activity. They cited the Splendorio case. Is inspecting a building or site with asbestos in it an extra hazardous activity? Of course not. It's not hazardous asbestos until it's disturbed or moved around or handled. So, of course, that's not an extra hazardous activity. In the last case, and these are all out-of-state cases, the last case is the Indiana case, which was thoroughly discussed at the Court of Appeals and now. And that was a case where an employee of an insulating contractor who the court acknowledged knew the hazards of asbestos, this is his company he worked for, in the 1960s, went into a power plant and used asbestos and was injured. Now he sued the power plant company. And the court said, wait a minute, Your employer knew about the hazards of asbestos in 1960. Your employer was the one that brought the asbestos into our site. We're not going to let you use the extra hazardous activity under these facts. And when you think about it, it does make sense, but that's not the facts we have here. FMC brought it into the purview of Mr. Tatera. And so I don't believe any of those cases out of state are on point.
Counsel, in thinking about Wagner and the quoted passages about vicarious liability, does that at all preclude someone from being negligent and a cause of action being maintained without a cause of action based on vicarious liability? In other words, negligence for their own acts as opposed to being negligence for someone else's act. I mean, that confuses me a little bit here because, boy, I would think someone would be first and foremost negligent and responsible for their own behavior and accountable for their own behavior. There may be causes of action exist for vicarious liability also, but why are we, it seems like we're missing, at least in this discussion, accountability and responsibility for their own behavior here.
And I agree, and that's why I contend that 388 is actually better suited to resolve this, because they are talking about their own behavior in that case, under that restatement section. Vicarious liability, obviously, we're going to show that they were liable. We're not going to show that B&M was liable and FMC did nothing, but just by nature of the law, they're here in front of you, jury. Our case is that they are liable, and
well,
I
counsel,
don't know.
The first Wagner exception itself is premised on the action, the conduct of the principal employer, right?
That's right.
And that would be the affirmative act of negligence.
That's right. The affirmative act of negligence. And in the case, and there are cases where, as the Chief Justice pointed out, it's difficult to say sometimes what an affirmative act is, especially when a company is bringing a hazardous product into the B&M. It seems pretty affirmative, but you could also phrase it as, and they're failing to warn when they bring it in, which, on the other hand, maybe it's not. But if you look at the cases that FMC cites to say these were not affirmative acts, they're pretty clear that they weren't. Negligent hiring, in this case, they're actually bringing the product into the place of business, and it's emitting fibers at the time it's brought in.
Negligent hiring is, you can say they hired someone who was incompetent. That's an affirmative act.
It could be rephrased as such, certainly. And it's difficult, exactly what you said, Chief, how it's in the phrasing.
Yeah, but that's why you get, if it continues affirmatively negligent that way, that's why your second prong becomes important, because you don't need an affirmative act there.
That's correct. You don't need an affirmative act there. And
you need
it seems to be that the main point of FMC and mainly the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance is, if you have any kind of protective measures whatsoever, then it's not an ultra-hazardous activity. And that can't be right, because even the examples given in Wagner, transporting hazardous waste and working with toxic gases, certainly protective measures you can take in doing that. Someone isn't injured automatically by using those, and it's pretty hard to differentiate working with toxic gases from working with toxic fibers.
You're not asking for a summary judgment for you, are you?
Oh. No, I'm not.
just you, a you just want to go to trial.
I'm not going to do that. I'm just looking to show that there's a reasonable issue of factor.
Could I ask a question? This phrase, use the chattel, is that broad enough to include changing the chattel?
I believe it is. Use the chattel, they're using it, and they're shaving off a thin layer. But And when you look at the Hayes case, and that's the sand, the silica, and that was the one the court had recently involving, they're changing that. They're sandblasting and creating new a new chemical product. In this case, they're just shaving off a layer, and the process dust is created. So I think you could draw the line, and there certainly could be cases where you're making an entire different product, entirely different product, as in the Hayes case, but I don't believe this is the case.
Did 388 come up in the Hayes case?
I don't have the Hayes in front of me. I believe it did, and I do know the sophisticated user was actually discussed by the Court of Appeals. It wasn't discussed at this court.
Counsel, I'd like to go back to the negligent hiring hypothetical posed a few moments ago by the Chief Justice. In order to find that an affirmative act of negligence, we'd have to overrule Wagner. True?
That's true.
And I'll duly note it, she made that vigorous argument in her dissent in that case, but Wagner appears to be the law.
Wagner is the law as far as negligent hiring. Whether or not this is affirmative act, I think it is different when they're bringing the product into their place of business. I see the red light.
You have a few moments to sum up rapidly.
I will do so. On behalf of Mrs. Tatera, I would ask that this court affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals.
Any changes in the Court of Appeals decision that you want?
The only change I would make is that the Court of Appeals said, we're not going to actually decide today whether this is a contract or subcontractor situation. I would just like it clarified that 388 actually applies first. Because of a bailment, we have different rules for people when we have bailments. We have to look at that. This is a specific situation.
Thank you, counsel. Erosha.
Thank you. Mrs. Prosser, I'd like to start off by addressing one of the things you brought up, and you asked about, well, why not a passive? Why the exception for the affirmative act? And, you know, Wagner is the law. Wagner forms the framework that we're following in this case, and it's based upon sound public policy principles that are set forth in the decision. But I think the one that really hits home on the question that you're asking, Justice Prosser, is the whole idea of retained control. I mean, otherwise, you're making the principal responsible for what happens to an employee over which it has no ability to exercise control. It also recognizes the statutory non-delegable duty imposed upon employers by the Safe Place Statute. So not only does it make sense, it's based upon sound public policy. And then there's all the other policy behind Wagner that supports it. The discussion about vicarious liability, you know, Justice Gableman, I'll have to go back and take a look at exactly what the decision says with regard to the extra hazardous exception. But I don't understand it. I know, Chief Justice, you discussed it in your dissent, but, you know, Wagner's been the law now for 22 years. The facts of Wagner did not involve vicarious liability, so I think we know what that means.
And that wasn't discussed in my dissent. I mean, it was discussed, but not directly on Part 2. It was discussed in the discussion of Part 1 of the Affirmative Act.
Okay. And, Justice Prosser, you have some questions about this disc, and that could lead on. Maybe it will lead on a whole line here, but I can describe one, or we actually have one here if you'd like to see one, a non-asbestos-containing one. And I don't know if you were in track in high school, but maybe you've seen a discus, and that's the best example I can come up with without actually showing you one. They're rock solid hard parts, and I'm standing before you today to tell you that if you know, I've tried to in my brief hone in on the parts of the record that preclude this going back to the trial court. You know, the trial court found that the affirmative act didn't apply. The trial court applying the proper standard, the Court of Appeals didn't apply the proper standard. They talk about the dangerous product standard or something, and they didn't even use the proper standard that is discussed in Wagner. And the trial court said the accident hazardous exception did not apply. Justice Gibbon, I think you understand the difference between inherently dangerous absent special precautions and extra hazardous, but I just want to be sure.
You're talking about the construction hypothetical versus the handling of radioactive waste.
I'm talking about the Wagner decision went through a whole big, long, lengthy discussion about do we adopt the lower standard of inherently dangerous absent special precautions, or do we adopt the higher standard of extra hazardous? And based upon lengthy discussion and a lot of thinking, they decided to adopt the extra hazardous standard. And that's exactly what it is. What it means and what the case says is that extra hazardous is one where the risk of harm remains unreasonably high no matter how carefully it is undertaken. And the one case on point, and it is on point, the case from the Supreme Court of Indiana, this PSI energy case, I think they use a little bit different terminology, but they're essentially applying the extra hazardous exception, and they're saying that asbestos is not an extra hazardous activity. And one of their reasons was because plaintiff's complaint flew in the face of what they were arguing, because plaintiff says that you didn't warn us about precautions that we should have taken. Well, if it's extra hazardous, if you give a warning, it doesn't do any good. And so if you go back and you take a look at that case, which the Court of Appeals didn't even mention, by the way. The Court of Appeals didn't, you know, Justice Bradley and you talked about this affidavit, mm-hmm. No safe level of exposure. Well, I've got a whole analogy I can go through. But even if we talk about, you know, what's happening here is a problem that happens in these cases because it becomes asbestos is asbestos is asbestos. And that it should not be happening in this case if you take a look at the record. We're not talking about raw asbestos fibers. We're talking about this friction disc in which it's encapsulated. And we have a big disagreement about what exactly was being done with these. We concede that they've done enough to create an issue of fact that some of these discs ended up there and something was done with them. But that issue of fact doesn't get you a trial.
Mr. DeRochers, you're not on television every day. I would love to see the disc.
Do you object, counsel? Why don't you peek at it before we peek at it?
I see it now, and I'm still wondering if that were the size of this piece of case with that arm.
Well, we'll see it knowing that it may not be the
knowing that it may not be relevant.
Right.
May I approach?
Carefully. The disc with a hole in it.
Like a small frisbee with a hole in it.
Okay.
My time's up, and I wish it wasn't, but if I could just have a moment to briefly summarize. I'm here to tell you that the Court of Appeals got it wrong. You know,
that message.
Okay. Well, maybe I should just sit down then, Justice.
You can tell us how in a moment if you want.
And the only other, I'll make this part of my summary. When you asked me about should you look at 388 first or should you look at Wagner first,
What I was trying to figure out is whether I should argue 388 first, because I think that's, if you get there, you don't get past it for the reasons that I said. I don't see how, as part of the legal analysis, you do anything other than look at the relationship of the parties, which is exactly what it was, and you can't ignore that it was a principal independent contractor relationship.
So. I assume you agree that a bailee can be an independent contractor. Maybe you don't.
I think I haven't seen technically, you know, now we're referring to 388 as the
Bailment or supplier.
Yes, and I thought it was a stretch when we started talking about bailment to begin with. I haven't seen a bailment case that fits our factual situation, and I looked, and the best that I could come up with is the one that I cited to you, and that's that case from Alabama where they talk about a bailment for repair, and I would simply submit that if you find that bailment applies, the analysis is still the same, and it doesn't change the conclusion. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Thank you, Mr. Cahill, and Ms. Rakowski for your arguments today on a return to Wagner and a new view on Section 388. That ends our argument on COAAP 170. Tatera versus FMC Corporation. The court will appear in closed conference at 3:20. The court is in recess until next week, I believe it is, when we will hear additional oral arguments. We're also in session on Monday when we will have a rules hearing. We are in recess.